The Brief is supported by Bloomberg Connects, the free arts and culture app. Sadiq Khan pledges to end rough sleeping in the capital. The Grenfell Inquiry's final report delayed yet again. Gender pay gap widening among UK architecture's biggest firms. And the AJ and Save launch a competition to rethink demolition plans for the M&S on Oxford Street. My name is Merlin Fulcher. I'm an architectural journalist, and I'll be bringing you a roundup of this week's big stories in architecture, planning, and housing news. Welcome to The Brief from Open City. My guest this week is Eleanor Jolliffe. Eleanor is an architect, author, and columnist. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So the gender pay gap reported by the UK's top 10 architecture practices has widened since figures were last published a year ago. The latest figures, which were published in the AJ this week, show that women employed by the 10 biggest firms were typically paid 15% less than men as of the 5th of April 2023. This is the same disparity that existed a year earlier and higher than the 14% gap in 2021, indicating a clear lack of progress in gender income equality for architects. Of the 10 practices analysed by the AJ, BDP had the highest pay gap, with median hourly pay for women 20% lower than for men. Stride Treglown was only just behind with a 19.8% gulf, while Alford Hall Monaghan Morris reported a 16.5% disparity. The two practices with the best figures in 2022 both saw the biggest gender pay gap increases. So Foster & Partners' 10.5% disparity grew to 14.4% in 2023, while Hawkins Brown's 8.2% gap grew to 12.9%. Meanwhile, Grimshaw's 9.9% gap made it the only firm among those analysed to pay women more than 90 pence for every pound it handed out to men. Studio Berman Architects Director Zoe Berman, who founded the Built Environment Equality Action Group Part W, said low pay hit minority groups and women the hardest. She said, quote, "To look at the injustices in equitable salaries, we have to look at architectural fees. These are one and the same problem. Year on year, the RIVA reports on salaries paid, but that simply reflects a poor situation without doing anything to tackle the constant race to the bottom on design fees." Berman added, quote, "Fair fee scales will have a positive benefit for women, underrepresented groups, single parents, and those with diverse needs. In turn, equitable salaries will ensure more women can afford to both join and remain in the sector, bringing the value of female experience to the table in shaping the places and spaces in which we live." So last week, government figures showed that the overall gender pay gap had fallen to its lowest level since reporting became mandatory for businesses in 2017. However, despite this, nearly 4 in 5 companies and public bodies are still paying men more than women. So, Eleanor, why is this still such a big issue?
I just want to sort of caveat that I think it's worth noting that the gender pay gap, it's not a measure of equal pay. I don't think anyone's suggesting that any of those practices are breaking the law by not paying women the same as men for the same work. But I think the trouble in architecture is, like any profession, you're fighting the demographics of the profession. You can't become a senior architect overnight. You've got to have years of experience. And bluntly speaking, the figures are a little bit skewed by those earning the most. And in architecture, that is men, because 50, 30 years ago, as sort of the most senior people were coming through, there was very few women. I think that is changing. I think the difficulty as well with the figures we're seeing is that the only companies that need to report on gender pay gap figures are those with over 250 employees. For the vast majority of architecture firms reporting, they're probably between 250 and 300 employees. So the sort of increased gender pay gap you're seeing might be one female director who's gone on maternity leave this year, or one female partner who's retired. So statistics can be tricky. I think especially when we're looking at firms that are only just over that limit, we need to be careful what we're drawing from it. I would definitely agree there's a gender problem within architecture. There are definitely more men than women, but at the junior end of the profession, you see that much less. So I'm not personally worried, and this is speaking as an architect who is a woman, I'm not personally worried about 2 years worth of smaller fluctuations. If we're still having this conversation in 10 years, then yes, we've got a big problem. And I think that's why it's important to check, but maybe not get too worried about little shifts.
So just to hone in on Zoe Berman's point, so you say there are fluctuations and statistics can sometimes suggest trends which might not fully reflect the full picture. What Zoe Berman, if we zoom in on what she's saying here, is that obviously there were issues with the gender pay gap, but the root cause that Berman is identifying is architects' fees and the business model of how architects as businesses get paid and then how that then filters down to the rest of the company. What do you say to that?
I think she's got a good point. I think her point about fee scales would be very tricky. They were phased out in the 80s and 90s when the Monopolies and Mergers Commission said it was monopoly behaviour. I think it'd be very difficult to bring them back. I also think that architectural services as an industry is struggling a little bit at the moment due to the increased fragmentation of the construction industry and the services that most architectural practices take on, the increasing distance from construction, from taking the design responsibility, from taking responsibility for design, for building regulations compliance, all of those aspects, those more technical, arguably less fun aspects, make it harder to command high fees. There is a race to the bottom on fees. People have talked about that, but I think it's not just about the fees, it's about what role architects are prepared to play in the industry.
An ideas competition exploring possible new leases of life for the Marks & Spencer Oxford Street building has been launched by the AJ in partnership with Save Britain's Heritage. Following a protracted battle over the future of the building, earlier this month, a High Court judge ruled that Community Secretary Michael Gove must re-examine his decision to reject planning permission for a proposal by M&S to demolish the structure, which dates back to 1929, and replace it with a new 10-storey office and retail building. Amid this uncertainty, the free-to-enter Restore competition, which is independent of M&S, aims to tap into the creativity and talent of architects and others in the built environment to discover whether a sustainable and pragmatic revitalisation of the building might actually be possible. AJ editor Emily Booth said, quote, "We're excited to launch this competition with Save Britain's Heritage to encourage creative ideas, promote debate and share imaginative approaches for building reuse. In the face of the climate emergency and pressures on high streets around the country, we hope Restore will act as a catalyst for fresh thinking." Save director Henrietta Billings said, quote, "The question of how to handle the future of prominent retail buildings like the M&S store on Oxford Street is being played out in high streets and town centres across the UK. We hope this competition will spark fresh and imaginative ideas about new lives for these well-loved city centre landmarks, fit for a climate-conscious 21st century and beyond that everyone can benefit from. According to the brief, entries should strive to meet 5 objectives, including prioritising whole-life carbon design principles, preserving heritage, and recognising the challenges facing the world-famous Oxford Street and potentially other high streets. The competition is open to UK-based architects, architecture assistants and architecture students and has a closing date of Wednesday the 24th of April. A short list of 6 entries will be paid honorariums of £5,000 per team to develop their ideas with no overall winner selected." Okay, so Eleanor, what do you think about ideas being used to change the dial on this highly contentious project? What kind of things would you like to see come forward in the proposals and who would you like to see enter?
I think it's a really nice idea. I hope it succeeds because though the Pilbrown Partners scheme is interesting, it doesn't feel like that building needs to be demolished for this for all sorts of reasons. To return to our previous question about fees and low fees, whether the Architects Journal should be encouraging architects to do work for free is perhaps another question. But
I think they get paid honorariums of £5,000 per team.
Everyone who enters?
I think the initial round is specifically tailored to be as little as possible. So it's like, yeah, then you get paid £5,000 to actually do some work. Yeah.
It would be really interesting to see some ideas that are both socially valuable but also commercially viable. Because if M&S or any of the actual decision makers in this project are going to take notice of this, it will be because it's financially viable, because that seems to be what's driving a lot of the development there and a lot of the argument around that building being demolished.
I mean, it's interesting that we're living through an age of like quite a lot of campaigns, conservation campaigns around high profile buildings, also taking an environmental edge, looking at embodied carbon. A few years ago, we covered the Tulip Tower being rejected on embodied carbon grounds. It seems like the dial's kind of shifting there. And I think it was in the breaking news just recently that Secretary of State's issued a Article 31 holding direction on the Museum of London building in Bastion House. So this is a story which is basically broken while we were writing our script. Are we living through a potential kind of step change when it comes to these historic buildings and finding future uses for them rather than pulling them down? Because, you know, certainly in the past, big conservation battles in the pages of the architectural press, they didn't always end up seeing the minister stepping in and basically doing sometimes what the conservationists want.
I hope so. I hope it is a step change. I think some of the demolition arguments I've seen in the past have been around whether those buildings are fit for use, sort of. For instance, office buildings coming down because they're 20 centimetres different floor to floor heights than ideal office standards. And so people are saying, oh, it doesn't meet regulations. And I think it's sort of finding those nuanced positions that actually just because there's a 20 centimetre difference in the ceiling height, it doesn't mean the building isn't going to be viable anymore. But I think that requires a little bit of flexibility across the industry and some slightly more joined up guidance and building regulations.
So what's interesting about the AJ and Save competition, it's in this long tradition of putting out ideas into the public space to kind of create a public debate, to shift the dial, so to speak, and to give people the sort of visuals to imagine a different future, whether they're the building owner themselves or the politician or an interested member of the public. Now, in the news this week, there's another example of which has happened, and it's the Heatherwick Studio and the ongoing Humanise campaign. So in an effort to shift the dial, create a new public debate over architecture, the latest instalment of the ongoing Humanise campaigns published a series of, quote, boring alter egos for some of the UK's top landmarks. So that includes places like Buckingham Palace, Edinburgh Castle, Gold Hill in Dorset, kind of remaking them as whatever, brutalist architecture. So the Heatherwick Studio said, quote, using artificial intelligence fed with 75 years of soulless development data, the project reimagines Britain's most beloved buildings through the eyes of its most boring architectural trends, end quote. So Eleanor, have you had a chance to have a look at these? What do you make of them? Do you think they're going to strike a chord with the public?
I have looked at them. I think they're a little bit intellectually dishonest, really.
Ooh, yeah, tell me, how does that work?
So, for instance, Buckingham Palace has been reimagined as an office block with glass curtain walling, which, even sort of stylistic arguments aside, Buckingham Palace wasn't built as a sort of mass-produced, commercially viable type scheme. So if you were going to reimagine it in a sort of more arguably internationalist style, you do it sort of a little bit more like the Shard or the Gherkin, something where they've put loads of money into something really iconic. The same with the Palaces of Westminster. That one looked a little bit like they'd sort of taken, it almost looked a bit Barbican-esque.
It looked a bit like residential. Civic.
Yeah. So I think they're being, whether it's deliberate or not, I don't know. It depends how they generated the images, but
AI, I think it just doesn't have that nuance that you've got.
There's no nuance, and it just felt a bit like they're trying to make headlines without actually putting enough of the background research in first to make the argument as strongly as they want to. Whether I agree with their basic point is a different thing. I think there's a real place in cities for quote unquote boring architecture. I don't think you want streets full of buildings that are all trying to be icons. You need just good quality background architecture for the vast majority of your city. Otherwise, stuff like the Shard doesn't stand out. And it just becomes too much visual clutter and too overwhelming. So I see his point, but I think there's space for all sorts of different designers in architecture and all sorts of different architectural tastes. And I don't know that those images are achieving what they want them to. And in fact, till you pointed them out, I hadn't come across them. No one that I know is talking about them.
But just as an aside, that Aston Webb facade elevation on Buckingham Palace is actually a modular construction. So it is, but of course, it's a home and then also somewhat a civic building, not an office building. But it is actually itself, one could argue, a kind of boring, soulless cobbling together of panels. Basically, it was a proto-modernist thing. And it's, it definitely divides opinion. Like, it's not the most loved thing, bit of architecture and landmark. Certainly. Now, just coming back to it, though, we know there is a sort of disconnect between what people in the architectural press or architecture industry, people like me and you, think and say about architecture and what the wider public think. And there's, I believe, part of this campaign and part of the work that Heatherwick Studio is doing around Humanise is to sort of step over the views of people like me and you and say there needs to be a bigger discourse. You're just as aware of this as they are, I'm sure. What do you think of the sort of tactics for doing that they've taken? Is that paying off? Are we seeing a wider discourse around architecture in a way that is actually going to knock the profession into shape and get us, you know, a bit less preachy about high modernism or whatever? Do you see what I mean? Like, because I think there's a noble goal there, right?
Yeah.
But
you know,
what do you think of that?
I think it is a noble goal. I don't know how successful that particular campaign is being, judging from sort of universally similar reviews on the book that I don't think was that favourably received by any of the newspapers that I've seen. But I do think it's important. I do think architects talk too much in an echo chamber to the other members of the profession. I don't know if I think Thomas Heatherwick is the best person to start the discussion, but I'm glad that he is. But I think it's being done in quite a deliberate way that I don't know if I agree with.
And that is provocative, or just you just think it's or too simplistic? Or
I think it's a bit too simplistic in that I think more people should talk about architecture. I think everyone has an opinion on architecture. All of us live in buildings, or most of us. All of us are in buildings every day. Therefore, everyone should have an opinion about them and should feel entitled to have an opinion about them without knowing architecture speak. But Thomas Heatherwick is quite a controversial designer sometimes, even outside of the architecture profession. And I don't know that his framing of this argument is going to draw in the broader public. I feel like if you had someone, I'm not saying Kevin MacLeod should start a big discussion about it, but somebody who's seen as a bit more down to earth, whereas Thomas Heatherwick, for all that he's not an architect, speaks architect as more than most architects I know, to be frank.
I think I'd be really interested in an organisation investing some serious money and time in conversations with people and actually listening and then creating a brief for a campaign around this. Because, you know, the classic thing for me as an architectural journalist, you get in a taxi, you're chatting, and they say, what do you do? So I'm an architectural journalist. They tell you, oh, I hate all this modern architecture. I say, okay, what's your favourite building in London? They say St Pancras, this Midland Grand Hotel. And then I say, oh, what do you think of the Great Court of the British Museum? And they say, oh, I absolutely love it. It's fantastic. I was like, okay, well, you know, that's Foster and Partners. It's a very, you could say, boring technical structure. You know, it's like a geometric shape. But, you know, so basically, yeah, that's just one tiny example. But always, anyone you speak to, opinions on architecture are far more advanced and nuanced and complicated. And that has got to be the starting point, rather than it's boring.
Oh, definitely. And I think it's giving people the language. It's the sort of, is it the Ford quote that he may not have said, if I asked people what they want, they would have said they wanted faster horses. It's sort of understanding what's behind people's reactions to architecture, even if they don't have the language architects are used to talking in. Mm. Everyone says they love Georgian terrace houses. And I love Georgian terrace houses, but I don't think they're the answer to everything. And I also think if you then started digging into a chat with somebody who's not an architect about why they love it, it might not be that they particularly love that style. They just like the way the light works in the rooms, or the size of the rooms, or the height of the ceiling. Or
the location those buildings happen to be in, because they were all built in the nicest bits of London that was the time they were built. You know?
Or the fact that the trees have been there for 100 years, so they're nice, big, mature trees outside. Like, there's so many other reasons other than just it's the sash windows. Or
publication of the Grenfell Tower Inquiry's final report has been pushed back again in the third delay to the process. This was reported by the AJ this week. The inquiry team had hoped to release its second and final report about the fatal fire before the 7th anniversary on the 14th of June. However, it now expects to publish its findings about the fire even later this summer. This is the third time the inquiry has delayed publication of the report. Initially due in late 2023, it was delayed until early 2024 last May and further delayed until summer 2024 in November. Explaining the latest delay, the team leading the probe said contacting individuals who are criticised in the report had been a significantly larger and more complex process than anticipated. Announcing the delay to the report, the inquiry team acknowledged the public's desire to see the findings as soon as possible, but explained the extra time was necessary to ensure the report was complete and accurate and conveys a definitive version of events. The inquiry was initiated 2 weeks after the disaster, which took place on the 14th of June 2017 in the Grenfell Tower, a 24-storey block of flats in North Kensington, West London, and it killed 72 people. The inquiry's Phase 1 report was published in October 2019, focusing on events during the fire itself. The second study will examine the causes of the fire. Once the final report has been sent to the Prime Minister, the government is expected to publish the landmark document promptly. So, Eleanor, what's this all about? Why does this report keep getting pushed back? And what is the impact of this on survivors and families of the victims?
I think it must be tremendously frustrating, and my heart really goes out to them, because 7 years on after such a major event and sort of a major catastrophe in so many people's lives, it must be very difficult to get closure and to move on from that. It must sort of not be helping with their process of grief and recovery from this. So you'd hope that when the report comes out, it might help with that. However, anyone who works in construction knows how complicated it can be, especially when you're talking about public procurement, as you would be in this case, because it's a council property. You sort of hinted in the question, lots of people have been criticised and they're going to them for comment. I imagine they're not in a hurry to return comments. Perhaps they're sort of making sure they've covered all their bases. And this also feels like one of those how long is a piece of string questions. At what point do you stop investigating? I don't think you'll ever reach, with something like this, the definitive answer at the end of it, because you could follow every supply chain of every material used in that building. But you've got to know when to stop. And I wonder if perhaps that's been the difficulty with this, knowing at what point you stop in order to have a comprehensive report that answers the questions and is useful. My nervousness as well going forwards with this is that it's now been so long that some of the sort of broader reaction around the Grenfell fire has died down a bit. So I hope that when the report does come out, there's findings that can be usefully implemented rather than it just sort of ending up on a shelf in someone's office.
Yeah. The past 7 years, there have been headlines all along the way where it has been absolutely shocking, like the revelations that have been shown. The finger has been pointed at many things, so that nothing has been done in 7 years. And, you know, some of these companies, some of these practices, some of these activities still exist in our present era. 7 years, a lot of stuff's been built since then. You can sort of feel that there's been a missed opportunity for justice to happen sooner and for the process of justice, which is to sort of to bring about a finality and a conclusion to something, but then also to implement those changes.
Definitely, especially because the Building Safety Act came into law 2022. It would have been good to have had this before then, in case there's findings in this report that could have fed into that legislation.
Now, also in the news this week, there's been a story about a post-war housing estate in southeast London. This is residents of the Lesness estate in Thamesmead are protesting Peabody's decision to demolish nearly 600 homes and replace them with 1,950 new homes designed by McCrane and Lavington. So a group of residents called Lesres, aka Lesres Resistance, and Housing Rebellion activists have squatted a building on the estate, refusing to move until they speak to Peabody's director, John Lewis. So, Eleanor, what's your take on this? Because, you know, estate regeneration projects have been contentious in the past. They're still contentious now. Why do things like this still go on, you know, considering that there's been so much discussion around how to do projects like this in a way which is socially and environmentally sustainable, for example? What does that actually look like in reality?
Homes are fundamentally emotive. It's where you're at home, and change is quite scary. And regardless of what the change is, and when the change is about your home, regardless of whether your home is perfect to start with, you're going to resist it because it's sort of people coming into your personal space and it feels closer than just a building. I don't know this housing estate personally, I've not been there, but when you're talking about the number of increased homes there in a part of London where they are densifying to try and increase the number of homes in the capital, I can completely see the arguments for regenerating that area. But I think it does get difficult. As I said, you're talking about people's homes and you need to talk to the communities there. But there is an element with sort of a very hard-headed hat on that if this is something from the 60s that's fundamentally unsound housing, it's probably not a bad thing to regenerate, but it'll just take a long time.
So I can hear what you're saying. It's a perfectly rational argument. However, we also, you know, live in a society where if there's like a terrace of privately owned homes, an enormous amount of money will be spent to like dig a tunnel around it or something like that to make sure you can't possibly compulsory purchase and demolish that person's house or whatever. Why is it so socially, economically acceptable to demolish someone in social housing, but completely unfathomable to do some kind of like townscape densification, knock down a load of privately owned homes in the centre of a town centre in order to build that density we really need? Because what we're talking about is a group of people who are marginalised enough in society, a group of people who, people living in Grenfell Tower, for example, and people living in similar social housing places which have also been underinvested in or cynically refurbished, who've been pretty badly treated by the consensus settlement around housing for the past few decades.
Maybe it's because I'm an architect and I come at it with this hat on, but the houses you've talked about that we are sort of digging expensive tunnels around are Victorian terraces. The ones that often get pulled down are 1960s slab development. And the former appears in all sorts of interiors magazine. The latter is normally sort of the beginning of some drama about social problems on the BBC. I wonder if part of it is to do with our attitude towards different architectural styles and what sort of heritage we're prepared to invest in as a country. I'm sure the individual owners also make a difference in sort of the complexities of dealing with 15 or 20 private owners as opposed to one council owner who can sort of get the flats back.
London Mayor Sadiq Khan has pledged to end homelessness in London, quote, once and for all, as he announces an extra £10 million will be spent on tackling the crisis if he is elected for a third term. This was reported in The Guardian and The Big Issue this week. The number of people sleeping rough in the capital has reached the highest level in a decade. The closing quarter of 2023 saw nearly 4,400 people sleeping rough, the most since records began in 2014, and that equates to a 23% year-on-year increase. Khan announced the major manifesto commitment ahead of the upcoming 2nd of May election, which will see the incumbent mayor bid for an historic third term in office at City Hall against Conservative challenger Susan Hall. He described the homelessness crisis as a scandal which must be condemned to history. City Hall's rough sleeping budget rose from £8.45 million in 2016 to £36.3 million in 2023. This new pledge would see an additional £10 million added to the pot over the next 3 years, a sum which would go towards doubling the number of so-called ending homelessness hubs and provide support to help people on the streets to rebuild their lives. However, while welcoming the pledge of additional funding, many experts in the sector say this simply does not go far enough. So Tom Kerridge from the youth homelessness charity Centrepoint said the funding required to properly support young people facing rough sleeping fell in the dozens of millions. In Newham alone, the borough with the fifth highest homeless population after Westminster, Camden, Ealing and Lambeth, an estimated £32 million are needed to meet the needs of young people in the area, according to research by Centrepoint. Okay, so since Sadiq Khan became mayor, homelessness in the capital has risen by a staggering 71%. However, in his statement, Khan blamed the government for not doing enough to tackle the crisis. So, Eleanor, what do you make of all this? Who actually has the power here to change this situation for homeless people?
I mean, it's such a huge problem, isn't it, homelessness? And what you don't see, because we've all seen more people out on the street, but you don't see all the hidden homelessness, the people whose rents get cut short, the shared flats stop working out and they're on people's couches and stuff. 10 million sounds like a lot of money, but I just don't, it feels like a sticking plaster. And I'd be really surprised if it actually solves it, let alone once and for all. When you think about the root causes of homelessness rather than the symptoms, I think you need to think about the supply of housing and the geography of the UK economy. I mean, there's so much pressure on housing in the capital. So you're driving more people to live here and there's fewer and fewer places that are affordable to live. And I don't think 10 million is going to solve that.
So right now, ministers are facing a revolt from their own MPs over the government's flagship crime bill, which would effectively criminalise those who sleep on the streets and allow police to fine or move on nuisance rough sleepers. Meanwhile, this week also marked the five-year anniversary of the government's pledge to end no-fault evictions. In that time, more than 30,000 households have faced a no-fault eviction, pushing more people further towards homelessness. And obviously, that hasn't become law yet. Eleanor, is there evidence to show these approaches work when it comes to addressing the issues of rough sleeping? And if not, what strategies should policymakers be looking at?
When I first heard about this, it just reminded me of that George Orwell book, Down and Out in London and Paris, where George Orwell spent time sleeping rough. And at the time, you couldn't stay in one place longer than a certain amount of time. So he and all the other homeless people at the time were just walking between cities. And it made for a really interesting book, but I don't know that it makes for brilliant policy. And if it didn't work in the past and we got rid of it, why are we bringing it back? What's changed? And again, I think it's a supply chain issue. There just isn't enough affordable and suitable housing.
Okay, so we're going to move on to the culture section. So Eleanor, as well as being an architect and columnist, you're an author. So your book is titled Architect, The Evolving Story of a Profession. It was published by RIBA Books last year. Perhaps you could give us an overview of the book.
Sure, I'd love to. So this was looking at how the profession that I'm in has developed pretty much since humans started, but basically since ancient Egypt, and just charting through quite quickly the role architects have played within the construction industry from then until now, very much in the Western world. And it's been really interesting to see the change over time and how slowly divorced architects have become, especially over the last 100 or so years from construction itself. And it's acted as a bit of a wake-up call to me and sort of reinforced some instincts I thought I had about the profession anyway.
And it's interesting because obviously the role of the architect and architecture has shifted a lot, because at times it might have been like military or infrastructure, then it's all to do with prestige and aristocracy and power. Then there's a brief moment where it's to do with the public good, and then it's to do with like free market financial determinism or something in the present era. What inspired you to write this book? Because I'm getting the impression you're quite a historian as well. You're passionate about history.
I am. I kind of think everything's been tried before and it's worth sort of seeing how it worked out last time. What inspired me to write it was I was hearing lots of colleagues talking about how wonderful being an architect was 30, 40 years ago, like when their parents were or things like this. And I realised I didn't really know anything about that. And I went to find a book because I'm a bit of a nerd and that's my answer to everything. When I then started looking into it, it wasn't as much of a golden era as everyone seems to think it was. Like, the evidence just isn't there. Actually, those salaried architects working for the London County Council Architects Department were technically earning less than those in private practice, but they had pensions and nobody in private practice had pensions, or they had guaranteed salaries and people in private practice didn't. It was so much more nuanced than the stuff we've just sort of learned by rote coming through and the sort of rumours that get passed on. But nobody had looked at this for a while. So my co-author Paul and I sort of discovered that for the last 30, 40 years, no one had written this book and it needed some updating. So,
and what's the kind of weirdest thing that stood out along the way when you were researching it?
I don't know if it was weirdest or most encouraging, but that we were trying quite hard to find stories of people who weren't just the architects you'd expect, which is fairly difficult because women or minority groups, they're not as well documented in the past. But what was really encouraging was, especially as a woman, how present women have been throughout architectural history, just haven't always used the term architect. You get really sort of involved, quote, annoying clients, perhaps, like especially aristocratic women, because they had a lot of money at their disposal. you get these sort of letters from architects being really snotty about this female patron because she's getting in the way and changing things and making us put corridors in where we don't want them and things like this. And that was quite encouraging.
So where should listeners go to get a non-Amazon-enabled copy of the book?
It is available direct from the RIBA or Waterstones or any other bookseller.
Fantastic. So in other news, Open City is looking for a new podcast producer. So are you a fan of a show? This is your chance to come and work with us. Open City is hiring a new podcast producer to work on this show and across all of Open City's podcast output. It includes spin-off shows and audio tours of the city. So if you're enthusiastic about the topics we discuss on this show and have audio production experience, we want to hear from you. Go to the Open City website to find out more about the position and also how to apply. The only other thing on the culture sheet is the upcoming Baylight Fellowship visit to Poundbury, which we're planning on Friday the 14th of June. You can now go on our website and get tickets to spend the day with architects and property, housing commissioning type people across the public and private sector and also the Open City Tours team. Poundbury is a multi-decade ongoing development built on Duchy of Cornwall land in accordance with the principles of architecture and urban planning as advocated by King Charles III in his 1989 book A Vision of Britain, just in case you don't know what Poundbury is. We went last year and the conversations and the insights we had with the people we went with, which is includes Ross Sharp, the architect, and also Matthew Lloyd Roberts, the architectural historian, were absolutely fantastic. It was a really, really insightful experience. So I'd recommend anyone joining. Thank you so much for being on the show, Eleanor. I hope you can join us again one day in the future. Where should our listeners go to stay up to speed on your writing and output? For example, is there a social media handle or website they should go to?
Yeah, so I'm on Instagram at Eleanor_Jolliffe and also on LinkedIn.
Fantastic. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to The Brief from Open City, made in association with the London Society and the 20th Century Society. This show is made possible in part thanks to Bloomberg Connects, a free digital guide to art and cultural organisations around the world. A link to download Bloomberg Connects is in the show notes. If you've enjoyed The Brief and want to know more about any of the stories we've discussed, we recommend subscribing to The Architect's Journal, which covers all these issues and many more. To get early ad-free access to The Brief and support Open City's wider work, empowering young people from underrepresented communities, please become an Open City friend today. The link is in the show notes. The Brief is produced by Poppy Waring and hosted by Phineas Harper, Merlin Fulcher, Cyber Chatter, and Fran Williams. The series editor is Merlin Fulcher. Our theme music is by Chris Zabriskie. Open City is dedicated to making cities everywhere more open, accessible, and equitable.